Blog Talk Radio.
We're on. November 11th, 2010. And tonight we are featuring a panel discussion on hypnosis and magic. I'm your host, Poke Runyon, and I will introduce the topic and I'll review my article on the subject that was published in 1978 in Gnostica number 45. And hypnosis is self-hypnosis. Have been the operative techniques behind visionary magic all the way back to ancient times. But this secret has been and is still being suppressed. Now, our call-in guest speaker tonight will be Ann Finnan, First Lady of the Roebuck, a cult author, and a professionally trained hypnotist. And Dr. X is on hand with us here in the studio to add his comments. And this is a show that you don't want to miss. And as I said in the abstract we posted, tune in, relax, completely relax, and listen to my voice. Now, when I count to three, you will be fully awake and alert and completely refreshed. And ready for the show. One, two, three. And now we'll get on into it. Hypnosis and self-hypnosis are so important to ceremonial magic that it is amazing to me. And I was really amazed to discover when I got into magic that people just were in denial on this, and most of the writers on magic wouldn't discuss it at all, and they just avoided it completely. And I wanted to know why, because I was, when I had my visionary experience and discovered how to actually conjure a visible appearance back in 1969, 1970 when we got started. Self-hypnosis and hypnosis was the cornerstone of what we were doing. And I couldn't figure out why, when we were so successful, and we could conjure a visible appearance in the dark mirror, we could communicate with the spirits, we could do all of this, and we could do it, I would say easily, but we could do it consistently, and we could train people to do it, even people who were not naturally clairvoyant, we could train them to do it. And we used hypnosis and self-hypnosis and hypnosis, and of course yoga along with it, in order to condition them to be able to do this and to be able to receive and to communicate with the other world. I could not understand why this wasn't recognized. Now, I got to admit that maybe back when I was a kid in college, way back then, that maybe I got a leg up on this by seeing a movie that I have earlier recommended on an earlier show. and I heartily recommend it along with this subject. Came out in 1948-49. It's called Black Magic, and it starred Orson Welles. And this was the very romanticized story of Count Cagliostro, the famous or infamous magician who flourished right before and managed to survive the French Revolution, and of course was involved in the affair of the diamond necklace and according to this version of the show, learned the technique from Anton Mesmer, and then became a remarkable hypnotist. Of course, in those days they didn't even use the term hypnosis. The term hypnosis wasn't brought into the lexicon until 1840 by a medical doctor by the name of Braid. He's the guy who first talked about hypnosis. Before that, it was called mesmerism, and it was developed by Anton Mesmer. And it had a lot to do, and according to Mesmer's theory, with animal magnetism and the mesmerists in those days. Oh, they did the passes with the hands. They were very forceful and they were very much like Bela Lugosi in Dracula. It was this kind of an effect, and this is what Orson Welles used in Black Magic. And I was just really impressed by that when I saw it as a kid. I saw this, I thought, well, yeah, that's right. So here I find out, you know, and I get into this, I have my vision, I get into this whole thing, and naturally, having, you know, seen Orson do it in such a effective way, you know, in a film, you know, I mean, I just knew that was it, so I went ahead that way, and I couldn't figure out. Here we were having these results, we had results, and that nobody else could really do. I mean, we actually did it, and we were the only ones back in those days that could do it. And so I couldn't figure out why. Why don't the rest of the magicians, why didn't Regardi, Crowley, and all the rest of these people, why didn't Mathers and whatever, why didn't they know? And Barden knew, but Barden didn't even want to emphasize. He didn't want to emphasize hypnosis. He was a hypnotist himself. That was in fact, he was a very good stage hypnotist and mesmerist. But Barden didn't want to mention it. So I got to the point where I really wanted to find out why. So, of course, that required a little bit of research to find out why. And I did, and I found out that mesmerism got a very, very bad reputation because of the power of these mesmerists on stage back especially during the Victorian age. And they had England, they were a lot of our magic got started at that time. These mesmerists were a sensation on stage. And they would do things that even today, hypnotists don't do on stage today. They made these passes and they demanded that they could come out and snap their fingers and put somebody into a deep somnambulistic trance. They could slap somebody on the head and put them out just like this, and it scared people. It really did, and that was the time when the story of Trilby and Svengali came out. And Svengali was this sinister foreign villain with the mustache, you know, and the slick black hair and all of that. And he was the hypnotist, and Trilby was the beautiful blonde girl and innocent, you know. And this was a best-selling novel at the time, and it's made into a movie and a play and everything else. And Svengali became a household word. Svengali was the mesmeristic sorcerer who could control and dominate people. Now, this is the reason why they both, the OTO and the Golden Dawn, both had, in their oaths, they said, you will never allow anyone to hypnotize you. And this was the reason. Now, hypnosis also, the other reason, and then there's another reason beyond that, the other reason is that the hypnosis brings out of your mind, or can bring out of your mind, what the hypnotist wants to bring out of your mind. The hypnotist can lead you into any kind of fantasy that he wants to create. He can lead you into it. We've seen examples of this, and tragic examples of this in this satanic ritual abuse scandal that swept the whole country, where these psychotherapists were, or not even in deep hypnosis, just in reverie, they were suggesting all of this stuff to these impressionable kids, and there are people in jail. There's still people in jail all over the country, are still in jail on the fantasies that were created by these people suggesting and leading these young impressionable young people into saying these things. So you can dominate the imagination, and you can control the mind by doing this, and there's no doubt about that. And of course, hypnosis has got cleaned up, and they all say, oh, well, you can't make anybody do anything against their will and all the rest of that stuff. That's not true. Hypnosis is a very, very effective, and it is a form of mind control. So consequently, if it's going to be used, it's got to be used responsibly, and the people who in, you know, engage in it, like in ritual magic, we have to have a give and take, and we have to have a standard format, and everybody has to follow. You can't be allowing someone to get into your head and do whatever they want to do, and so that's a given. But then, you know, we never said that ceremonial magic didn't have its dangers. Of course it does. So if you admit that hypnosis is what makes it work, then, of course, obviously, then the person who is being ritually hypnotized should be as much of a hypnotist as the person who's doing the hypnotizing. And therefore, self-hypnosis, before you get started, is a prerequisite. Now, when we got into this, got going with it, and were in operation for several years, Ann Finnan, who is now, as they say, the first lady of the Roebuck, which is a very well established and a very fine Celtic Wiccan tradition. Ann studied with me for a while, and then went on to go and become actually a professional hypnotist. She took several courses, and she accredited courses, and she really knows magical hypnosis. And Ann's waiting to call in, and I'd like to go ahead and have her call in now, Ann, and we'll get you on here, and we'll talk about this, and see if we can exchange some views on it. So if you're there, go ahead and give us a call in. Meanwhile, Ann, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, folks.
Oh, good. By the way, first, before we get started, let's plug your book. I just saw it on Amazon, and tell us a little bit about this new novel you have out.
Well, the novel is a young adult. How it was described to me was Harry Potter meets The Name of the Rose. It's a young adult adventure, fantasy, magical adventure that takes place in 15th century France, where a young man is rescued from an auto da fe in the middle of the town square of Orleans by a very mysterious priest who does things like command it to rain and command earthquakes and command windstorms and things like this. And this young man is taken to this monastery, which is an actual Benedictine monastery, and he finds the other monks there are practice alchemy and astrology and herbalism and seership and swordsmanship and all these sorts of things.
Excuse me, is this the one where you have the elixir?
Yes, they make this this wine that has not only is alchemically formulated, it has strange, mysterious herbal tinctures in it, and it gets the reputation for being the cure for what ails you, whatever it is that ails you, and an elixir vitae that becomes very popular with the nobility. And
did you get an endorsement from the Chartreuse from the monks that make Chartreuse?
No, I didn't. It was purely fictional, and I think that the monks would probably be not terribly pleased with me if I implied that they used almadels and alchemical furnaces
they use alchemical furnaces. We know that because Chartreuse is supposed to be an alchemical elixir. Anyway, and the Goths love it, by the way. but now to the subject of hypnosis. Well, what's the title of the book again, so that everybody knows?
The book is called The Sorcerer of Saint Felice, and it's available on Amazon. It came out in June, so. Just boot me up and on Amazon, and you will find not only that book, but my first book, which was the Forge of Tubal Cain, which describes how we put together the Roebuck and some of the influences that led to our use of hypnosis and certain other psychological techniques in our particular form of magic, which is very, very much like yours. It's very visionary. It's very trance heavy, and people learn how to go into trance and do the magic work that way.
Yeah. I made the statement, and which I think you probably agree with, that in magic especially, the first thing that the student should learn before they learn just about anything else is self-hypnosis.
Absolutely, because one of the things that we stress and most reliable magical groups that do this stress that you are training your own mind to enter this particular magical state. And there, once you train yourself to do it, then you don't need somebody waving their hands over you and intoning, "Sleep now," and to do the work that you need to do.
Yeah, right. And also, something that I discovered and is that if you train yourself in self-hypnosis and you're talking out loud, making a loop from your mouth to your ear, and you're calling your subconscious, not you, you're saying you, you're always referring to your subconscious you, not I, or not me, you're saying you, as if your subconscious was a separate person, which kind of in a sense it almost is. And so, once you establish this, it helps, at least I found, that this establishing this loop helps you to develop the whole idea of communicating with other entities. In other words, hearing what they have to say, because you're talking to another entity inside yourself, and you're doing it out loud. So once you establish that, then we've discovered that what happens is you put the person in front of the dark mirror, and we go through the ritual, which is in itself hypnotic, and then I can be behind them, or you can be behind them as the Magus, and you can say, well, what does the spirit say? And the spirit will use their voice to talk, and then this trance becomes so, if you're really trained in self-hypnosis, this trance becomes so flexible that you can, the spirit will be talking through the mouth of the receiver, and then the operator will say, well, sister so-and-so or brother so-and-so, what do you think about this? And then you can make a comment, and then we go back and ask the spirit will make a comment, and all of this, so you have a three-way conversation going, and it's all out loud, and it's being, and you can't possibly do this unless you have really trained the receiver and the operator. You really got to be trained in self-hypnosis. Now, would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, your subconscious mind functions very much like a gatekeeper, like the psychopomp that goes back and forth from the upper world of the conscious mind to the underworld of the subconscious mind. So by making your subconscious into an entity of itself, you are giving it that mercurial psychopomp function of being able to go and see what the spirit has to say and then come back and report. It relieves the conscious mind of trying to figure out what the spirit is saying and becoming annoyed or distressed that it makes no sense. And sometimes it doesn't. When we do some of our contact work, we will have somebody says, well, the spirit is showing me yada da yada da yada and is saying this and this and this, and I have absolutely no idea what that means. And the person for whom the message is standing there with their mouth open going, oh, my God. You know? So it relieves the conscious critical functions of trying to edit what is coming through in order to make it either make sense or water it down so it's not quite so distressing.
Yeah, that's absolutely, that's very well put. You know, one of the things, of course, that I said earlier when we introduced all of this is that we really do have to realize that all of this business of hypnosis not being that the person under hypnosis won't say anything, think anything, or do anything against their will or anything like that, that we can't lead anybody into anything. That's not true. And hypnosis can be misused, very definitely. And we know that. We know that.
It can be misused only to the extent that the subject wishes it so. This is what you have something that hypnotherapists call demand characteristics, where you have a situation set up so that in order to please the hypnotist, the subject will say or do certain things in order to get attention or in order to comply with whatever is being wanted. You see this in stage hypnotism all the time, where you have somebody who is so delighted to be on stage in front of a group of people that they will, walk about and cluck like a chicken and flap their arms and do this sorts of things. Not so much because they want to do that particular action, but that they are trying to please the hypnotist, or they're trying to comply with whatever is being expected of them, which is the whole big problem with the situation with the satanic abuse victims. They wanted to blame all of their problems on this particular incident, and the hypnotist very conveniently gave them a bogeyman to blame all their problems on. And so they can toddle off and say, oh, well, you know, I'm not overweight because I eat too much. I'm overweight because I was, abused in the satanic ritual as a child. And you have an unspoken approval of the therapist. These therapists had an agenda, as we all know, those of us who were who were in the LA area when all this was going down. They had they wanted desperately to find victims of satanic abuse for a variety of reasons. And so whenever a victim would comply and come up with all of these memories, then they got approval. They got
Actually, this was done more in a very light state of hypnosis, this sort of thing. It was done in a reverie more than what we were in a deep state of hypnosis. But still, it's the same effect. You can, like, the reason why I'm mentioning this is not so much to mention the dangers of it, but the fact that the hypnosis can be, and it is with our path workings. I mean, we can lead you along and describe an interplane path. The operator can, of course, the operator is going to be in a trance himself, in a sense. But we can lead you down this path. We can describe the path, and then we can use the attention points on the path to get something out of your own deep mind, and we can do this. So we're in a sense leading you, even though we're at a certain point, if we're responsible with it, we're letting you pull out from the symbolism what's individual to you from the symbolism we're providing. Now that's responsible, but
it's also a matter of implied consent. You've got people who are in your temple or in your circle or in your ritual are there by their own free will. They choose to be there.
Yeah.
So they
are
consenting.
You and I both know, and he's dead now, so I'm not going to mention his name even though he's dead, but you and I both know an operator, we know him rather well, who would take people on path workings, unstructured path workings, into the darkest reaches of his own mind. And oh boy, I mean, if you really want to have a spooky, well, it's just spooky. It was sometimes it got scary experience. That was it. But that's not a good thing to do at all. And a responsible magician should never do that.
Well, it depends on what he's doing. I mean, if the whole point of using these techniques is to either train students to do it themselves or to get everybody on the same psychic page and to do some kind of work. So it's a kind of an implied consent. Most of the people who are in these groups could pick up and leave if they wanted to, except in certain rare circumstances where there's actual, you know, physical coercion involved. People can just decide that this is not for them and walk out the door. So if they stay, then you've got other issues.
The point I'm making is about admitting, not just admitting, but actually making it a part of your doctrine that, yes, we use hypnosis, and we use it, but we expect everybody, receivers, operators, leaders, students, everybody, we expect them to be just as skilled and just as knowledgeable about the process as those of us who are using it. So therefore, it is a consent thing, and like you say, you can walk anytime you want to. You're not being brainwashed or anything like that, because you know what's going on, and you should know beforehand. Granted, magic is what you learn from the symbolism when you get into a path work, you say, or into an operation. What you learn, that's novel and new and can be disturbing, maybe, but at least you know what the structure is. And you know what the structure is before you get into it.
And that needs to be part of the magical syllabus that the student is presented with, that right up front. They need to know that this is what we're going to be doing, and this is why, and this is the we spend a whole session before we even go into trance induction is, okay, this is what we're doing and this is why, and this is some of the problems that people have with it, but this is why we're doing it and this is what to expect from it, and that this is a this is self-hypnosis, and whatever suggestions that, say, I would be giving to you in the pathworking or in the circle is scripted. Here's the script. You can read it if you absolutely must, and that this is where we're going and this is what we're going to be experiencing. And
yeah,
after
right.
a certain number of these pathworkings, which always has the same structured induction, you will be able to do it yourself, and then you won't need me anymore. And that's then you become the initiate rather than the student. It's
yeah,
part of the package.
Of course, we should mention that that the reason why Kirpal Singh kind of backed off from Paul Twitchell in Ekankar was because Paul Twitchell was letting these people go off into the astral by themselves and have their own, and Kirpal Singh said, no, look, now this is for instructional purposes. We lead people along on these things and give them the attention points. It's all structured. Now you're teaching them to go off and wander around on the astral plane. Well, actually, I'm a little bit sympathetic to Twitchell. But I'm also sympathetic to Kirpal's point of view, you know?
Well, it's, there are still New Age, quote, New Age shamanic workshops that where this is still done. And I sat in on one at Pantheon some years ago and took some notes, and just basically it was that same sort of thing that you lie on the floor and they put you in this trance, and then they beat a drum and let you go wherever you're going to go. And most of that, as we know, is from our magical structure, is that there's a difference between the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious. And if all you're doing is giving somebody a nice daydream where they are wonderful people and they do wonderful things, and they come back and they have their wolf spirit guide and their Native American spirit friend or whatever, and they're all happy and they pay their money and everybody's happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Occasionally you do have somebody who has a problem, or somebody who has an issue with some of the darker forces, and will stumble past the threshold into the collective unconscious, and that's where, you know, here there be dragons, and those are the folk that end up with the nightmares.
Yeah, let's mention for a minute, while you mention that, let's mention for a minute that Carl Jung in this, I started off with realizing back in 1970 that Jung's concept of the collective unconscious was very, very important to the magical field theory that we were in developing in conjunction with this hypnotic thing, because the collective unconscious, according to Carl Jung, is something we all share, and this is the transitive point. Now, a lot of people, you know, they say, oh, well, you're talking about hypnosis, that means it's all in your head. Well, yeah, maybe it is, but like Lon Duquette says, it's all in your head, but you have no idea how big your head is.
Or maybe you step into a rabbit hole and you go from your own wish fulfillment fantasy down into the realms of the cliff off. And you never know when that's going to happen.
Yeah.
This is what theosophists called the astral plane, and you've got the upper astral and you've got the lower astral.
Oh.
And some people kind of simply by being curious will go through the wrong door. And
right.
And they end up in an astral hell, and they wonder how in the heck they got there. This is one of the reasons why you have to go along with them, or you have to have somebody who goes along with them to find out if they're going to end up being, you know, creature food.
Yeah. One of the things we do with our hypnotic path workings and with our various interplane operations is we recover past lives, and that can be kind of scary, and it can be kind of exhilarating. It can be very informative, and it can be and of course it can also be misleading if you don't do it right. I'm going to turn you over to Dr. X. That's Mark Delson, who's right here. You know Mark. And
hi,
he's
Mark.
Right here by me. And I'll turn you over to Mark, and you guys can talk about this past life thing for a little bit from a hypnotic perspective. Take it away, Mark.
Hi, Alan.
Hey, Mark. How are you doing?
Very well. Say, I wanted to touch up on past life regression by hypnosis as well as some of the healing aspects that one might have during that time as well. Have you covered that much?
A little bit. We don't do a lot of past life work as a group because unless there is a reason for it, you can get people who become past life junkies, and they come to Circle not to do the work of the group, but they come to Circle to find out, you know, their own past history. And that is more of an individual one-on-one thing than we would do in a group or coven setting. I've been both the subject and the operator on past life work, and it's very, very amazing stuff. It's however, unless this is something that the group is involved with, it's less to do with magic and more to do with personal spiritual development, which is
isn't spiritual development part of the purpose of magic?
It can be. It's but if you are working within a group, you
mm-hmm.
have a group purpose. And if the group purpose is to explore a past, say, a shared past life where everybody in the group shares a past experience. We've done work with that. But individual past lives we don't pursue in the Circle environment simply because it doesn't serve the rest of the group. But if you have someone with a personal problem that comes over on an off night and we go out in the temple and do some personal work, yeah, then absolutely. And it can make the person be a better operator and a better magician, but it's not the sort of thing you do in a group.
Okay, I understand. I could not hear part of the conversation, so I didn't realize that you were focused mostly on group activities rather than group and or individual activities.
Well, they come together in the sense that the individual is operating, say if they're doing a contact, or if they're doing a scrying, or if they're doing say a path working where we send them off into some realm and they report back what they've seen, and we've done that many times, particularly during shape-shifting exercises, where you turn somebody into a bird and they fly off and they may make observations and then they come back and they tell you what they saw. That is something that affects the entire group. But individual past lives, it's as Polk said, there's a tremendous temptation to glamorize them. And it's very, very difficult to peel away the glamoury and discover just who these people were in the past. And, of course, everybody wants to be a druid in a past life, and everybody wants to be a witch in a past life and all of that. And you have, there are certain techniques that you can do to get more at the truth.
While you're on this subject, Dan spoke again. That exactly right. And I learned a technique. And you probably remember it. That I learned it from Dick Sutman. And Sukhvan did a lot of good ideas. When you get the person back into, through that birth experience, and back into that new, that past life, the first thing that Sukhvan did, and it really, really, really is, it works, is have, is say, okay, you open your spiritual eyes, you're in this past life, now look down at your feet. What kind of footwear are you wearing? And then you go from the feet up, and you, in the rest of the clothing, and you go all the way up the clothing, and then you go to the immediate surroundings, and then you go from there to the other side of it, you know, to what's outside the house or what's outside the building or whatever, or outside if it's area. And what this does is it keeps the person from it. There's no leading involved in this. In other words, this is really coming out of the depths of the subconscious mind. It's not something that's being led, and that's a wonderful technique. And so we use that. I remember, though, there's another thing that I want to mention too about this that we found out the hard way. You have to, when you do these past life regressions, you have to tell the subject, the person that's being regressed, you have to tell them not to become emotionally involved, to just be the observer, look at the life and observe it. Don't become emotionally involved. And the reason for that is you're going to take them all the way through to their death. And we had one of our people, you know who I'm talking about, who was a Welsh coal miner in a previous life, and had the mine cave in on him. Mm-hmm. And this was terrible. And this individual woke up in a. I realized at that point that you should always. When you do this, you make sure they don't get emotionally involved with it. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think if that's something that is if you suspect that there is an issue with an emotional imbalance, say for example, if somebody has a phobia, and they have gone through the whole psychotherapy thing, and they can't find anything in this life that would explain the phobia, and you want to explore possible past life reasons. You can also have them observe themselves in a mirror or in a bowl of water, or even if you want to get high tech about it, you can have them watch themselves on a television screen or something like that. If you suspect that there is an emotional issue, one of the things that I think I would like to bring up here is the kind of blurred boundaries between magic and therapy. And one of the big problems that hypnotherapists have is the therapeutic as opposed to the magical model. And one of the things that I encountered when I was studying, I studied with a man who was a former stage magician, a fellow. He passed away last May. He was taught here in Glendale for years and years. It was Gil Boyne. And he was a protege of Ormond McGill, who was a very popular stage magician and hypnotist in the 20s and 30s. So you had a lot of the grand gestures and the knocking on the forehead and knocking people on the floor and have them run about being chickens and this kind of thing, because that was what one did as a stage hypnotist. Then you had the Milton Erickson School, which was therapeutic hypnosis, which is something that that Freud was pioneering back in the day. So you had a different purpose of the trance induction. And one of the issues I think that you have with magicians and people who run magical lodges trying to do therapeutic hypnosis is what a psychologist will call an abreaction, which is somebody who freaks out in the middle of, say, a past life regression because you've touched a live wire. And it gets kinky because you don't know what the cause is and you don't quite know what to do about it, which is one of the reasons why, as apropos to what Mark said earlier, that's one of the reasons we don't do past life regressions in the circle, because we don't know what we're going to find, and it's, you know, I've had therapeutic experience, and I have a training in counseling and things, but I wouldn't feel competent to handle somebody who is all of a sudden screaming and writhing on the floor because they're going through some kind of experience. As I said,
that one experience, that was years and years and years ago. That one experience I had that with this reaction, and she recovered rather quickly from the coal miner incident, but so it wasn't anything terrible, but still it let me know that they have to, in order to avoid this sort of thing, you have to when they first do it, is to make sure that they're observing and they don't become emotionally involved, because if they do, then you can have this sort of thing. And a magician, frankly, has no business, as you say, has no business being a therapist. Ideally, you know, Rigardi used to say that, well, you should go through therapy before you ever practice magic. That was Rigardi's idea, and he was right. You have to have
a special therapist, though, because if you have one that considers magical ideation to be an indication of mental illness, then you've got a real problem.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, I think in a way, one of my advanced people and I were talking last night about. I know this is going to sound a little bit strange and a little bit shaky, but we were saying, well, where does clairvoyance end and insanity begin? Where do you draw the line, you know? Or does the line just kind of float around? Or should we say that, well, you can be clairvoyant up to the point where it becomes dysfunctional in your regular life, and at that point we're going to have to say you're insane. So there's a certain I think a degree of madness involved in what we do. But then again, on the other hand, maybe everybody, you know, everyone is strange but me and thee, and even thou art a little strange sometimes. So we need to kind of look at that and say, well, now just how far do we want to go, and just how far do we want to let this go? So I think that the magician should always be aware of that. He should always be aware, especially if he's working with people who are extremely clairvoyant. They extreme clairvoyance, or you know, it tends to go along with a certain amount of instability. So
well,
I think
there's also the bucket of cold water that one can have in at the edge of the circle. So if somebody goes off into some sort of fantasy about what they're seeing or whatever, then one can do a reality check. We do this all the time when we do psychic work, and when we have a group of people in the circle, say for example somebody is conjuring up one of our gods and goddesses and is claiming that they are saying this and that they look like that and all that, and so we have a debriefing afterwards where everybody sits in the living room and has coffee, and we go around the circle and we say, okay, what did you see? What did you experience? And some of the more experienced people in the group will say, you know, I've talked to that particular goddess before, and I recognize that voice, or I recognize that figure of speech. I saw her face change, and I saw the goddess superimposed on her face, and you know, all of these experiences that will validate and corroborate the experience that they have. And then we get
what we call politicking on the ball. Now, if we're all sitting around the Almadel altar and we're all, you know, going around Robin and we're channeling, you know, Sister so-and-so, does the angel speak through you, you know, and then you start going. And then after you, that runs out, then you get Brother so-and-so, does the angel speak through you, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then on and on and on around. And then you can tell that some people, even though they're in a trance and even though they're being perfectly honest about it, that what they're saying relates, you know, it's politics. It's lodge politics. They're telling somebody else sitting around a circle what they ought to be doing. You know?
Well, this is a phenomena we call stained glassing. Is basically if you have somebody particularly who is channeling a particular goddess and they make the goddess say whatever they think the goddess should say, rather than what the goddess is actually saying.
Yeah, right.
And they can say, well, it wasn't me, it was the goddess, and she said this and this and this.
Yeah.
And you get all sorts of amazing stuff, particularly if the goddess is giving instructions to do something. You know, the goddess says you must do this and you must do that. And you know that this is something that the person who's doing the contact is would really, really like to see happen. But, of course, no one listens to them. But they'll listen to them if it's a goddess speaking. So,
you know, this is one of the very good reasons why, if you're going to do this sort of work, you should learn to do it in a group and not off by yourself somewhere. Because if you get off by yourself somewhere and you don't have a group of people that'll keep you, hopefully a group of people that'll keep you balanced, you can get off. You can really, really get off into weird and wild, you know, tangents.
This is where you get the you know, Thor told me to shoot you, or you know, or Thor told me to go and beat up this person, or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
There's nobody there to provide a reality check and say, well, you know, why would Thor want you to do that? Exposes the experience to, you know, the cold, clear light of reason. And this is where your critical faculties come in, and this is where you come out of the temple and you put on your thinking cap.
One of our older members who was very opinionated and very clairvoyant, he came in one night and came into the lodge room and roared in a big, loud voice. He said, "The Archangel Michael told me that we should all do this, this, and this." And, you know, this big roaring voice. And I looked at him and I said, "Brother," I said, "I talked to the Archangel Michael too, and he told me that we shouldn't do that, that, and that. And so that's your Archangel Michael, and I have my Archangel Michael, and everybody else has their own Archangel Michael. So let's just take it under advisement, all right?" And that's about the size of it. I mean, in other words, the entities speak through us, and in a channeling process, they do. And we all, if we do the training, self hypnosis and hypnosis, and we learn to do these techniques. Tradakam yoga, of course, is very important. If you're going to use a crystal ball and a dark mirror, you need Tradakam yoga experience. You need that fixed gaze. Calming your mind. I don't like that expression, emptying your mind. That's Eastern. We calm the mind. Calm the mind, focus on the ball. Don't think of anything, and you know, especially don't think of the hippopotamus, and stare at it. That, yeah.
Yeah, you did. You thought of the hippopotamus, didn't you?
That is one of the power of suggestion, you know, you won't think of a pink hippopotamus then with a tutu and dancing to ballet music, then no. There you go, and you can't not think about it. One of the things that we were taught originally in psychotherapy in hypnotherapy training was you can use these don't think of a pink hippopotamus suggestions to get a resistant client. You know, you could have him back into trance that way, you know. These little tricks of the trade that we learned simply because my teachers were all stage hypnotists, and you know, you don't have, you're not being paid $80 an hour to sit there with a client who's going to come back the next week. You know, you've got to do your thing right there, and if somebody isn't cooperating, you have to either, you know, push the envelope or get yourself another subject. So there's lots of little tricks you can use, not to control people, but to
facilitate,
maybe unravel people's ego structure a bit, to the point where maybe a little bit of the sweet wine of humility can seep in, and they realize that they are not the great clairvoyants that they thought they were, and that maybe their visions and their voices are unique to them, and that nobody else shares them. We've all been in situations where somebody has been channeling something and all this beautiful stuff is happening, and everybody else is sitting in the circle going, I don't see anything, do you? Nah, I, you know. So,
well, this is why, as I say, it's so important to have a stable, steady group to work with when you do this sort of thing. And if everybody understands that this is a subjective process, And you admit that it's a subjective process, and you know that, then you don't have you can judge the channeling, and you can judge the knowings on their own merit, not on the idea that heavens, this is the voice of God, or this is gospel because it comes from trance. Then you take a I'm not going to call it a scientific view, but you take a rational, studied view of what's going on, and that way magic can be not a delusional thing. I mean, it because you can really get the good out of it, still maintain the glamour, still maintain the mystery, still maintain the transcendental and the transpersonal aspect of it, especially with the collective unconscious theory, and yet at the same time, it will lead you upward and not downward. Thanks a lot, Ann. Thanks a lot for calling in, and we'll look for your book. And we're going to be off next week with Thanksgiving, next Thursday. So we're going to be off the air because we're going to have, you know, Thanksgiving dinner and all of that, and let you guys do that too. And we'll be back the following week. We'll be back with another, what Ed Sullivan used to call, a really big show. So,
well, thanks for having me, folks.
Okay. Good magic. Bye-bye.